This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 105. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched its latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, which has a completely redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, 15 new templates so your website looks the best that it can, and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. Try the new Squarespace with a free trial at squarespace.com and be sure to enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, start here, go anywhere. And by Fracture. Fracture is an awesome way to print your photos. It's totally unique from what you normally see because the photo is actually printed on the glass. And so it has just kind of a luminescent kind of feel. The colors just feel wet and super, super glossy. But at the same time, it doesn't catch glare quite as much as I thought it would. It's just a beautiful and unique way to print your photos. So be sure to check out Fracture. Now, their website is fractureme.com, and you can get 15% off by using coupon code PHOTOSONGLASS15, all one word, PHOTOSONGLASS15. And their prints start at just $15. So be sure to check them out at Fracture. I love mine sitting on the dresser behind me. I think it just looks really, really good. So check them out at fractureme.com. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I am your host, Jim Harmer, and I'm joined, as always, by my friend, Darren Meller.
Hey, Jim, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. We got a ton of questions from our listeners on Facebook, and in this episode and the next few, we're going to go through a lot of those questions. We wanted to kind of mix things up and bring up a lot of some of the questions that we don't hear as often on the show, and so we're here to answer them.
Yeah, I think we should get started right away. Which one do you want to start with, Jim?
Boy, they all look good. Let's start with this first one from Jack Del Ponte. Jack says, "Hey guys, I'm getting started in photography and have been doing a little bit of wildlife and landscape shooting. I was wondering about tips you have for shooting in cold weather and snow in terms of tips for composing shots and getting good snow shots, but also tips for protecting your gear and elements, etc." All right. We've talked a lot of times about how to protect your gear in cold weather, but we haven't talked very much about composition and just getting good photos in the weather, in cold weather. And I just did this weekend. I took my boys up ice fishing and we went up. It was a great trip, but I made sure to do a lot of photography along the way. And some of the things that I was looking for are, one, wherever we have kind of the frosted trees, you know, where there's fresh snow on the trees, always looks really, really good in a winter photo. If you wait too late in the day or on a day where it wasn't particularly cold during the night, you don't have as much snow and frost on the trees. And I always feel like that takes away a little bit from the landscape. I like seeing the white of the snow on the ground carried through to the trees. It just has such a serene feeling to it. So as we were driving, I was looking for areas that still had that frost on the pine trees. And then the other thing is, you have a huge amount of white in the scene. And so if you aren't careful with your composition, you can have giant chunks of just white in the scene. And sometimes it can just look kind of boring or kind of offset different elements you have in your composition. So watch out for those white spots. And the last thing is, sometimes, not always, but sometimes during the winter, you can extend your shooting hours significantly. I took a photo that I was really happy with at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Terrible time to shoot normally, but sometimes a blue sky is a nice contrast with the white snow. And so don't be married to just the morning and evening like we often are in landscape photography.
And I would also look for some patchy clouds to make that blue sky a little bit more interesting. And
yeah.
And also for his way to prevent condensation on the bag we have, or on the camera, we have recommended in the past. It's real simple and easy. Just put your camera inside of a Ziploc bag before and after you move from a warm area to an extreme cold area. It helps the condensation stick to the bag and not the camera.
Good question. And another question from Stephen Miller. Steven says he was in the Sedona, Arizona area taking photos of Devil's Bridge. I've never been there, but you were in Arizona, so maybe you're going to be better to answer this question, Darren. He says he shot a 4-bracket HDR shot since the arch was completely enveloped in the mountain's shadow. He shot, his settings were ISO 400, F14, and he set up the composition to have the arch in the snow in the foreground and the red rocks kind of in the background. And then, you know, he got his exposure and he did his HDR and it worked okay, but the picture turned out just a little bit kind of flat looking. And he sent us a picture, and I agree. I think it does look a little bit kind of lifeless, a little bit flat. And so, Darren, what do you think about the picture? What do you think's kind of missing in this shot?
Well, the background is very, very bright, and then the foreground, it's interesting, but just due to the shadow that's being cast over from the mountain, it just needs to be brightened up, and there also needs to be something to add interest into the foreground. To me, it's just two clashing areas where we have a potential for interesting in both the foreground and the background, but they're just clashing on exposure values because the background is just so darn bright in those deserty landscapes. It's just so hard to get what's in the far, far background clearly sharp and focused because of haze and dust that gets stirred up.
Yeah, what I see with the problem is the lighting is just boring. It looks like, you know, I was there at 10 o'clock, so I shot at 10 o'clock. And sometimes you're going to get lucky and that works. Like when I was shooting in the snow this weekend and it just looked good during the day. But often I find that's an excuse for not putting any thought into the lighting and just kind of being there when you're there and hoping it's good. And usually that results in some pretty dull lighting. It looks like the bottom was shot early in the morning with nice lighting, and the rest of it was shot at 2 o'clock once you get out of the shadow. And so I think the problem is the lighting. Everything else is probably fine in the photo.
Yeah, and I toyed around it in post-production, downloaded the photo just to see if I could help out, and there's just a limitation of what we could do, so I think I would actually try to make a trip back up to Sedona, reshoot the shot when we could get the lighting to come through a little bit more evenly on the top part of it, and then also hopefully have some light pass through that Devil's Arch if it matches up with the east-west variable that you want.
Yeah. All right. Kerry Weinstein Logger says, any tips for capturing the moonrise? Boy, there are a lot of different things you could do. But one of the biggest mistakes that people make when shooting the moon is trusting the light meter in your camera. It's going to get it so wrong. The moon is a lot brighter than we usually think it is, and everything around it is black. And so the camera is rarely going to get it right. It's always going to overexpose the moon. The moon's just going to be a big white circle without any detail. You won't be able to see the man in the moon, all the detail in there. So just be sure that you're closing down your exposure settings from where the camera probably thinks it should be.
Yes, and I do the same thing, and I also will underexpose the shot and then possibly see if I can't get the shot perfectly the way I want it to, I'll composite the moon in just by exposing the moon perfectly as well, which is similar to what you said, but sometimes I can do it in one frame, and I'm still trying to figure out how I pulled off this one shot of a moonrise during the blood moon eclipse that we had in California in April of 2014. But before we go too deep into that, let's keep on moving. And we have one from Dion Marion. He wants to know, what is the best filter to take pictures of the sky or moon at night? And he wants his pictures to look like he sees them with his eyes. This isn't something I would personally recommend a filter for. I think it's more along the lines of camera settings. Would you agree with that? Or would you still put a filter on there, Jim?
You know, I read the question and I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. I've never used a filter at night. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense why you would want to do that. I think some people kind of get the impression when they start in, you first get their filter like, ooh, more filter, better result. And usually, you know, you want to take a picture and see if there's a problem that you can fix with a filter. Filters aren't just like going to enhance your photo, you know, despite what it says at the camera store on the little filter labels, there is no HD filter, even though I see that all the time on filters. So I don't see any reason you'd use a filter. You know, a neutral density is not going to make any sense. It's already dark. Mm-hmm. A polarizer is not going to make a sense. We don't really want to take any glare off the sky or enhance any blues or contrast there. I just don't see this making any sense.
No, but one thing I would say after listening to the episode you recorded with Chris Smith is if you're doing landscape or urban photography of buildings and whatnot, you might actually benefit from a polarizer at night to get glare off of water if there's water in front of it, or you could mess around with using a neutral density filter when shooting a picture of a building and using bulb mode in your camera for a super long exposure. It might be something fun to play with. I don't know.
Actually, that's a good point. You just reminded me of something when you said that. I think I'm a liar because one time I was shooting the reflection of a building in water, and I wanted to enhance the reflection to make it a little bit stronger, and I tried a polarizer. It had a very minimal effect, but it was something. And so, maybe sometimes.
Yeah, maybe there's some application for it.
All right, Jolie Krause Gordon says, "Hi, Jim. Do you have any go-to settings on your camera that would be okay for most outdoor pictures?" Nope. This is somebody who's trying to get a workaround that doesn't want to learn the exposure triangle, and there just isn't one. You know, there's no silver bullet camera setting that's going to get you started. Outdoor is not a camera starter. Maybe we want a portrait with shallow depth of field. Maybe we're shooting a group picture when we need more depth of field. Maybe it's really bright. Maybe it's not. Maybe we're shooting a landscape. Maybe we're shooting macro. There's nothing like this. But if you do want a little bit of an idea where to get started, go to improvephotography.com/basics, or just go to improvephotography.com and click the big start here button on the front page of the website. And on that page that you go to, we have a little cheat sheet for camera settings. You know, if you are doing indoor sports, start here. You're doing landscape, start here. So maybe check that out. But just outdoor, there's so many different ways to go there. There's no way you could do that.
Yes, there's just too many variables within that question. And here's a more specific question I would like to answer. It's from Trudy Jackson. She says, "I have a Canon 60D with 3 lenses, and I would like to know the best way to get a diffuse seascape shot." And I'm understanding that as getting the water blurred out. And the way I would do that simply would just be using a tripod and a longer exposure, and use maybe a stop down aperture of maybe f/16, just so you can get as much in focus as possible.
Fred J. Bono asks, "I'd love to take more photos of the night sky, but I still get blurry pictures." Obviously the shutter speed is going to cause problems with night photos if anything's moving or you don't have a solid tripod. Mm-hmm. The next thing to look at is wind. Even with a solid tripod, wind can cause real problems with night photography. So check that. But one thing that people often don't realize that can cause a severe lack of sharpness in night photos, you know how sometimes you look at a night photo like of a city or something, and all of the individual little lights and street lights and everything just looks so crisp and perfect? One thing that can really stop that from happening that took me a long time to learn is a dirty lens. When you have your shutter open for a long, long time, you have a lot of light pouring through there, and if you have a dirty lens, it can cause little bits of flare and ghosting around different areas of the photo. And when you look at it at the night photo with that long exposure, it can just look generally not sharp and flary in kind of areas. And you think it's because of your lens or something you did with your camera settings, and actually you just kind of got a dirty lens. So that's something to check out for that's maybe a little bit less obvious. But it's especially exacerbated if you have a cheaper lens, I shouldn't say cheaper, if you have a lens that isn't built as well. Some lenses do a great job at being pretty resistant to glare, others not so good. So try different lenses and see which ones are going to work. But check out the glare. Sometimes this is a lot less obvious than you might think.
Yes, and actually one less obvious question that I haven't heard in a while is how to reduce banding within a photo, and usually that's something we don't hear very often. And to explain it quickly, and hopefully, and Jim can steer me in the right direction, it's when you see a photo and you start to just see bands of vertical or horizontal light in the photo that just create these weird distortions that just kind of make things look fake. So how would you approach getting rid of banding, Jim?
There's a lot, especially when you're shooting skies. Mm-hmm. I often see the banding, and it's you may not notice it if you don't have your screen color managed. But we're looking at the gradations, the way that one color transitions to a subtly different shade of that color, a little bit darker, a little bit brighter, something like that. There are some things you can do in post-processing to minimize this. Sometimes, especially if you're on a large, let's say a blue sky, or you're looking at, kind of a nice gradient from white to gray or something, you might see some banding in there. And so one thing you could do is just select that area and just kind of blur it out. Because if it's pure blue, doesn't matter if you've blurred it, right? And so that may be something to help, check your color space. I am still using sRGB. I can see good arguments for switching to Adobe RGB, but there are also some things against it. Right now, I'm sticking to sRGB until somebody can convince me otherwise. Make sure your screen's color managed so you can see it. You may just select the area and blur it out. And other than that, check your color space.
I would agree. And one other thing I would offer as a tip is if you're using Adobe Lightroom, go ahead and open up your detail slider, and you might have a little bit of color noise from messing with some settings inside Lightroom. That's something I've realized if I go a little bit too heavy on the vibrance or other aspects of brightening up the photo, if I reduce those noise sliders a little bit and it blurs out areas of the sky that don't need to be in focus, it gets rid of the banding and the rest of my photo stays sharp as it should.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I guess one more thing is check your screen too. It may be that the photo itself is fine and your screen just isn't able to handle that color gamut real well. And so you might just check it on another screen. One area that I think this is kind of comical, on the startup screen on a Mac, Macs use just the whole Apple interface uses a lot of very, very subtle gradients. And sometimes the Apple screens, I just can't quite handle it. And so you see banding, and I always think, now you knew what screen I would be seeing this on. It's not like Windows that could be with 100 different models. You knew it was going to be with a Mac. Why wouldn't you check the screen and see if this is going to look good? But anyway, we're going down a rat hole.
We kind of are. We have another question. It's from Tanya Paulina Ramirez. She says, "Hi, for pictures of skyscrapers, I use more ISO, but my pictures look wrong with no definition. What should I do?" I think lowering that ISO is really going to help you solve that problem, because ISO is a detail killer, especially if you get to those higher ISOs. You're going to squash your detail and undermine your efforts for getting a sharp photo.
Great point. All right. And one more question from Bilal Ahmed Qureshi. I have no idea if that's right. Which setting is best for a colorful image for landscapes? They want to get a really vivid color in their landscapes. I would say the best setting is lighting. If you have poor lighting in your photos, the colors are going to look bad. There's no, colorful setting in your camera. There's just not that. But the way that the lighting is in the landscape is going to control how colorful it is way more than anything else. Way, way, way more than anything else. You could do little things. You could set your picture style to have a little bit more color if you're shooting in JPEG. And even if you're shooting in RAW, it'll make a little bit of a difference in the preview. But by far, the most important thing is good lighting. So what kind of lighting makes a colorful photo? Well, first, you just don't want the lighting too bright. Like we saw in the photo that somebody asked about earlier, the problem was the background was just in mid-afternoon light, or even if it was 10 a.m., the sun was up and just a tiny light source on it. And so there was all kinds of haze on the horizon, and it was just so bright that it kind of drowned out the color. That's never going to look good. But also, there are some conditions that are especially good for bringing out the color, like fog. Man, if you want a photo to just really pop with rich color, shoot it in the fog, because the fog, adds just so much gray and stuff to the photo that it seems more neutral. That if you have any little bit of red or greenery in the scene, well, it really pops out. Even if it's not technically vibrant. Just the contrast of that against kind of a gray background of fog looks great.
Oh yeah, even a simple green street sign that you'd see on the side of a highway in America, that will look so pretty in a foggy background just because it's the only color that's present.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we have a lot more questions, and in the second part, I guess, of this episode, we want to get into the lighting and portrait kind of stuff. I know a lot of you are interested in that. But before we get into that, let's take just a minute and thank Squarespace. Squarespace is the best way that we have found for building your photography portfolio. You've got to have a photography portfolio. Even if you're just a hobbyist photographer, it's kind of disappointing as a photographer when you go out and you put so much work into a photo, you want to show them off, you want it to look good, and nobody really sees your photos. They just don't get the attention that you want. And if you have a really nice, well-built site that you can point people to so they can easily see your photos, that loads fast, looks good on any device, and is easy for you to update, you're going to get that feedback on your work that you want. And as a professional photographer, I mean, there is no substitute for having a website. At this point, you know, how technology has gone on for years now, you have to have a good, solid website, even if your business is predominantly offline. I love my Squarespace site. It's easy to update. It's very inexpensive. And we can get you some money off your Squarespace site if you use offer code IMPROVE when you check out at squarespace.com. And be sure to check them out. If you've seen it in the past, but you haven't used them yet, be sure to go back and check them, because there are 15 new designs. And I think some of them are going to work really, really well for photographers. So check out the new Squarespace 7 and their new design, squarespace.com, and enter promo code IMPROVE to get 10%. Off. Very cool. Well, we have a ton more questions here, so let's get started with Amanda Dawn Sills. She says, so lighting is an issue with me. Is there any online class that is affordable that I can do to help with my lighting skills? Are you kidding me? She threw me a softball. Totally threw me a softball. Yeah, we have a class on portrait and flash photography at photoclasses.com that you can check out. But you know what? Don't take it right now, because I'm working on redoing it, and I think you're really going to love it. It's going to take me a couple months to get it ready, but we have a lot of great classes up there. The Lightroom and Photoshop classes always get great reviews, as does the beginner class. But the portrait and flash photography class, I'm anxious to redo, and I got some cool new stuff coming up there. So don't take it right now, but give me a couple months on that one.
Yeah, and for the users who already subscribe to those classes, go ahead, be okay with everything, because the cool thing is you get to keep those videos for life, and you get to reap the benefits of the updated videos as well. So don't worry, we'll take care of you all as well.
Yeah, that's right. I have people that bought a class 3 years ago and still get, every time we release a new video, they check back in every couple months and they say, oh, there's new stuff in there. You know, it's pretty cool.
It is.
All right, Rachel Ellis asks, hey guys, I was curious if you have any tips on using the YN560 external flash. I know it takes practice and is a process of elimination, but are there any quick tips or tricks to figuring out approximately how much light you should need for standard portraits and snapshots so you don't end up blinding people during your adjustments? This would be helpful and appreciated. Okay, the way that I would do this is to think about how much light you need in the background. So let's say it's I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm trying to think of the balance between the ambient light and my flash. So let's say it's black outside. It's midnight. You're on the, you know, in Las Vegas, my least favorite city in the whole world, by the way.
Ditto.
I do not like being there. Every time there's a conference or something in Las Vegas, like the first night, you know, you keep your window open while you're sleeping and the lights and stuff. And then I was just like, shut the curtains. I just want to get out. It's just too much noise and stuff. I don't know. Don't like that city. Anyway, so you're taking a photo at midnight on the Las Vegas Strip, and you want to get all the lights and stuff in the background, but you need a little bit of flash to illuminate the person. So you may be tempted to think, oh, I need a lot of flash. It's dark out here. And so you crank your flash up to full power. well, what's that going to do? It's going to totally overpower all the lights in the background, and the background's going to appear black if you properly expose for the person. Your flash is just way drowning out everything in the background. So really, when you're shooting a night portrait, you want to turn your flash power way down as low as it'll possibly go. And I'll put on sometimes like a softbox and put an umbrella in front of that. And I'll hold a reflector or a diffuser in front of that. So it's just as the tiniest bit of light that we can possibly get out of this flash, because we only want to kiss of light so that we can still see the lights in the background so they aren't drowned out. So we're thinking about that ratio from the ambient light to your flash and how much you want that to be. Now let's say it's the middle of the day, it's super bright, and so if you were to take a regular a photo, the background can have a tendency to kind of look white, hazy, and kind of drowned out. And so we want to really pump up the flash power on the person we're taking a picture of so that we can stop down our camera settings and make the background not appear quite as bright. So all you really need to do when you're thinking of about how much flash power am I going to need is I'm most of the time thinking about ratios. What do I want the background to be? If I want the background darker, use a lot of flash. If I want the background brighter, use a little bit less flash.
Yes, and also for using more flash, also never be afraid to get another YN560 flash as well, because you might need more than one unit to overpower that ambient light that we're trying to shoot in a bright daylight setting.
Good point. Wendy Garfield Finkelgold says, when placing people in this order, son, subject. I don't understand this question. When placing people in this order, sun, subject, and me facing the sun and subject with my camera, I would get the subject too dark, say on a beach. Should I open up my camera settings? And then is the background blown out? Well, I guess we've kind of answered that with the last question. We're thinking about ratios and how much flash power we need for those current situations. Valentina Di Gaspari Loop says, what is the best setting of camera and flash for indoor events and photography? When the ceiling is too high to bounce a flash and you need to be fast to going around taking pictures. Usually when that's the case, I'll just set my, if the ceiling really is too high for a flash. And I find that photographers often think the ceiling's too high, but it's not. Mm-hmm. Usually, when I'm shooting in receptions or something, and they may have a 20-foot ceiling. What's that in meters? Maybe 7.5 meters, something like that.
Yeah, right.
A lot of photographers will say, whoa, ceiling's too high, I can't bounce the flash. Actually, you're going to be just fine bouncing flash in a room like that. Sometimes what I'll do if I'm going to shoot like a wedding reception, that I'm guessing it's that kind of thing that she's shooting, before the event starts, I just go grab 3 or 4 YN560s and I just go set them around the room. Just turn them on and set them all around the room. And then I'll put one YN560 on my camera. And then the other YN560s around the room, I'm just pointed up to the ceiling. And then when I take a picture, it just, boom, it illuminates the whole room, just gives the whole room a little bit of light so I can take the picture and it looks really good. Now, you want to be careful not to use too much flash, because you want to use the ambiance of the room, in a wedding reception. They've taken some thought to the lighting. And so you don't want to just make it look like it's daylight, but you do want some lights around the background so that you don't illuminate the person in the foreground too much and make the background seem black. Again, ratios.
All about ratios. And Andrew Kamenev, I'm sorry if I butchered his name, asks about any tips of using softboxes with Canon Speedlight, specifically the 430EX for portrait shoots. He says he's a newbie strobist with two flashes, two stands and triggers, and he uses an umbrella or softbox, or he wants to know whether using an umbrella or softbox is most useful for a portrait shoot in this case. I think it's kind of a toss-up between the umbrella and the diffuser that you're using of a softbox. If you can get a really large umbrella, it's going to be more beneficial than a smaller softbox, and vice versa. If you were getting a really large softbox, it's going to do you a lot better with larger groups, especially to get that nice soft light if you want to use a diffuser of any sort.
Good point. All right. Adam Collins says, hi guys. You talked about gel shifting when shooting with flash in the foreground to make a neutral sky look blue. What do I do when I'm shooting outdoor portraits at sunset? I'm using an umbrella with two YN560s firing into it. What gels would you recommend? Okay, the principle of gel shifting is that we put a color on the flash so that the person that's being hit by the flash will look one color, and then we change the white balance of the camera so that even that colored flash looks as if it's just white neutral light. And by changing the camera, the white balance, it also, of course, affects the color of light in the background. And since that background is not illuminated by the flash, it makes it turn a different color. Example, let's say it's just a cloudy day, boring looking, and you want to add a little bit of color to make it look like it's kind of blue hour in the background. So it's just that kind of moody blue in the sky. What you would do is you put on the opposite of blue on your flash, which is yellow. And so we put the yellow on the flash, and that illuminates the person. Then we change our white balance to incandescent or something that's going to adjust to yellow, which makes the gray sky turn moody blue. That's what gel shifting is. So let's apply that then to sunset. We have a sunset. The predominant color in a sunset is yellow. And so if we want the sunset to look more yellow, then we would put on a blue gel on the flash, and then we could do it. You have to be really careful with this because you can make the sunset that's already colorful look really colorful, like kind of crazy colorful. So you do want to use this with caution, but yeah, sure, it can work.
Yeah, it can work, and like you said, just make sure it doesn't turn radioactive. All right, our next question comes in from Wendy Smith Ozug, and she is having a difficult time photographing a large group of people in poor lighting and wants any suggestions that would be appreciated. I think it goes back to what Andrew was looking at. If you use a larger diffuser with a lighting source where you can diffuse the light evenly across a larger group, I think that's really going to help. Flash photography really seems like it's going to help out in this situation for you, Wendy.
Deb Burgess says, I have two Yongnuo RF603N flash triggers, and I want to buy one more. Do I need to buy them as a set, or can I simply add one to the existing set? Yeah, you can definitely add to the existing set. What I would do is spend the money that you're adding on these additional triggers and start buying some YN563s, because the threes have the receiver, the trigger receiver, built into the flash. And so you won't have to buy any triggers going forward. And as you add more flashes, you know, you'll already be set. So I would keep the flashes you have. They're useful. You can use them as optical slaves. But if you're pouring more money into this, I'd probably lean to the side of just getting a YN563. Then you only need one trigger on your camera and it can fire everything at once.
Yes, and our next question comes from Peter Watson. He occasionally photographs his mates in a band. He sounds Australian.
Yeah, I was going to say he's photographing his mates.
And he wants to know what the best approach...
Because mate in the United States means something very different. Like, he should not be mating with more than one person.
But
all his mates, he's
no, it's fine. But he wants to know what the best approach is for this type of photography, like show low lighting and with flash guns, etc. He wants to know what's the best approach. There could be a lot of approaches. I mean, it's one of those answers of it depends of what the setting that you're shooting is. I mean, if there's lots of stage lights, I would shoot with a wider aperture like f2.8, f4 at the max, and then just try to capture as much light and keep my ISO at a manageable level without greening the photo out too much.
Ms. Buki. It's real. I don't make this stuff up.
Nope.
Ms. Buki says, any tips or guidance on green screen or chroma key photography? And my tip is don't. I have tried green screen as a background when you're taking a picture of someone or something that you want to cut out and put on a background of something else, and the result is always terrible. It works great for video, and that's why we see, you know, the weatherman on TV is using a green screen. Because in video, they don't really have the time to cut things out. You know, there's motion and you can't cut out every single frame. So it just needs to be the easiest way possible to just select all of that green color and knock it out. In photography, we have the luxury of just taking one frame. And so we don't need the quickness of knocking it out. The problem is when you don't have the illusion of the composite masked by moving things with video. In a still photography, some of the light that hits that green screen inevitably bounces back and touches the person that's being photographed. And so when you take a picture of somebody on green screen and then you try to cut them out in Photoshop, you find that, you know, the edges of their hair, the arm hair, all around the edges of their body is super green and it looks very weird, and there's no way you can pass it off as a composite. So my tip for compositing is just have somebody stand a little bit in front of a white wall and don't put any light on the white wall. And then the white wall is going to go to kind of a neutral gray. And that's perfect for most backgrounds. You know, most backgrounds, middle gray is going to kind of sink in, be camouflage. And so that works great. In fact, when I'm compositing, I used to go through the trouble of setting up a gray background paper. I don't even do that anymore. When I want to composite somebody, I just, you know, say, hey, come into my house and stand a little bit in front of the white wall and just take a picture and it's set. Now, to be clear, you're not trying to make the white wall look white. You know, it's not like a white background. That's going to be tough to cut somebody out on. So you're not lighting the background. You're just letting the white background go to gray and it'll work perfectly.
Awesome. And last but not least, our question comes from Maggie Manchester, and she wants to know the perfect size and positioning for catchlights in people's eyes and how to achieve them. I don't really think there's a perfect size for catchlights. I think that it's really subjective based on how the picture is framed, how it's cropped, and how the medium of it looks. But I would say that maybe the best way to catch them is to use speed lights and use lighting modifiers so we can direct that light into their eyes or position our subject in a way to where the eye is actually being, or the light is actually being caught in the eye when we're photographing them.
Yeah, it really, I mean, there's no perfect answer here. I often find that if I'm doing a headshot, that the catchlights can get too big, that it's, you know, you can't really even see the eye anymore because the catchlights are humongous. So sometimes that's something to consider. But at the same time, I was walking through Target last week, going with the kids, shopping for their Ninja Turtle toys. And as we were walking through Target, I saw one of the, they had a big blow up picture of a headshot of a model in their pharmacy department, you know, his makeup ad or something like that. And the catchlights were just humongous. Like the whole eye was a catchlight, and you could totally see that this was a huge softbox that they were using. You could even see the baffles, it was such a big picture. But the catchlight kind of covered the whole eye in part of it, and it just looked really good. Gave the eye kind of a dimensional feel to it. It looked awesome. So there's no right or wrong to this, but sometimes I do find that the catchlights can be so big that it's a little bit weird looking.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to visit Target now because I didn't expect you to say so good. So really, it actually added to the intrinsic value of the photo, or?
Darren, don't you worry. I actually took a picture with my cell phone to show you.
Score!
So anyway, thank you all for the questions that you sent in for this episode. It's been really fun going through them, and we're going to have more for you next week. And thank you for your support of Improved Photography and all you guys do. You guys are awesome. We love you. Thank you for all your support and commenting on the things we do on Facebook and liking our posts and checking out the articles we do on improvephotography.com. It means a lot to us. Everybody have a great week, and we'll see you in another 7 days.
All right. See you soon.